What I'm going to be talking about today is the general subject of origins, and part of the idea for giving this sermon, and probably a follow-up or two maybe, is there was several television series that have been on recently. The MC is on several of these is Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is a physicist, and he had one on PBS that I think the name of it was Origins, and I don't know whether it was before or after, but anyway, he's got a book out that is based basically on what was on that PBS series, and the name of the book is Origins. And so he's talking about primarily the origins of the origin of the universe and the origin of life. Those kinds of topics are what he covered. And then I think it was it on Fox that he had this series, and I forgot what he called it, where he was talking about just the universe in general, from past to present and to future, that sort of thing. I didn't watch too much of that one. But anyway, he's been very popular on TV in the last few years with some of these series that he's been working on. And over the past, particularly this past month, I've been doing research and some writing for Life, Hope, and Truth on Proofs of God. And I was thinking, man, I've done all this work to put together a very short article. We try to keep these articles short because we want people to come in and read them and not get halfway through and say, this is too long, and go away. So we lumped them. So I said, I got a lot more material I can squeeze in those articles, so I'll hit all of y'all with it. So that's what I'm going to do today. And what I'm going to start out, you know, if you think back a few years ago, I did give some sermons on proofs of God. And I'm going to begin here by using some of the slides that I used then to lay a little historical background, a little bit of a framework in terms of what the way I want to approach this, because I want us to, I think we kind of get a little bit cowed by science and the things that scientists say and the self-assuredness that we know everything kind of thing. And I want to get across to you that that's not the case, and that there are lots of things that scientists don't know and don't even know how to know, so to speak. So I want to talk about that, but we need to kind of go back in history to begin with, and just give a little bit of background as to where science has come from. And so let's start going back in the to the second century, when Ptolemy laid out a cosmological model for the universe. He had it all figured out, he thought, that the Earth was the center of the universe, that the moon, the sun, and the planets all rotated around the Earth. All right, so this is a schematic of the kind of thing that he thought proposed. And, you know, from that time, when there was no such thing as telescopes, you know, whatever you saw is what you saw with the naked eye, it kind of seemed like this was the way things were, that everything was kind of revolving around the Earth. But there were some problems. And one of the problems was that some of these planets would reverse and go in the other direction. And this created a problem. In other words, they kind of thought they had it figured out. These orbits are perfect circles and so forth. But it didn't fit the experimental data, which is basically what they were observing by eye. Because sometimes these planets, instead of keeping in their orbital path, just stopped, reversed, and went the other way. At least that's the way it seemed from their vantage point on Earth. Now, what we refer to that is retrograde motion. And basically what happens, just looking at Earth and Mars, for example, when Earth and Mars are kind of side by side as they're orbiting, then the Earth has the inner orbit. It's the shorter distance to circle the sun. The Earth tends to move a little bit faster. And so it kind of passes, you might say, Mars. Now, if you think that the Earth is the center of the universe and is not moving, you know, it's like you're in a car that's passing another car. If you don't know your car is moving, it would look like the other car is going backwards. And that's, of course, what was going on, that it just looked that way because the theory was wrong, that this Earth is not the center of the universe, the sun is, and everything's orbiting about the sun. And but they didn't have the tools to really study the skies in the kind of detail to pick up on that. And so they said, well, something's off here. And so how do we fix it? And the way they said, well, we can't deny what we see with our own lying eyes, that kind of thing that people say. So we really need to adjust our theory. And so it didn't adjust the theory that that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. What they did is they adjusted the theory by coming up with something like this, that in addition to all the sun, the moon, the planets, and by the way, they didn't know all of them at that time. The furthest one out they knew about was Saturn. That was they couldn't see any further out than that. But they said, okay, we can explain these planets going backwards. Well, they must be in a little small orbit of some type. As they're going on their big orbit around the Earth, there must be a small orbit that they're also local. You might call it a local orbit. And that's why it looks like the planet's moving backwards. Okay, now, this kind of improved the accuracy of everything. You adjust those little circles, like around Mars, around Jupiter, around Saturn. If you adjust the diameter of those kind of things, you can kind of squeeze it in so it kind of fits the observations. I wouldn't know, say, reasonably well, but, you know, okay. Now, they're still off, and they knew they weren't quite right. But at least it gave them some estimate of where the planets are going to be at different times. Now, this is something that scientists do when the observations do not fit the theory. You have to change the theory. So they changed the theory by adding these little localized orbits for each of the planets. And, of course, the moon didn't have to have that kind of adjustment, because it does circle the Earth, but everything else needed some adjustments. So, and this is what scientists do sometimes, and I want to come back to this a little bit later on to point out some things about modern day discoveries and how we have to be a little bit cautious, because there's things that we simply don't know. And the theories may look pretty good, but there's sometimes some pretty big assumptions in there. And this was an assumption that turned out to be completely wrong. But yeah, we're talking back in the very early days, you might say, back in the 200s or so A.D. And this concept kind of held sway on down until around the time of Copernicus. Now we're up to the 1500s. And, of course, Copernicus proposed that the sun was the center of the universe and everything orbited around the sun. And so he basically got it right. And at that time, they still couldn't see past Saturn to know there were any other planets out past Saturn. But he had it basically right. He thought that that these orbits were perfect circles. They're not perfect. They're slightly elliptical. So he didn't have that part right. But this gave better accuracy in predicting where the heavenly bodies would be at any given time. And then not too long after that, the first telescopes were developed. And Galileo discovered, surprised, that Jupiter had some moons that were orbiting it, for example. And but now scientists could look further out into the universe, measure things more carefully with a telescope than you could by just kind of eyeballing it. And new information began to come in the early 1600s. Johann Kepler discovered that planets' orbits were elliptical. And basically, with that understanding, this is the first time that the observations you were seeing were really being could be predicted fairly accurately. So that was a big step forward. Now, other things were going on. The 1600s, that period of time, a lot was happening. You know, that period of the Age of Enlightenment, lots of things were going on. Scientific discoveries were happening left and right, but just a few of the more important ones to mention here. Isaac Newton developed the laws of motion, and that allowed for he did two things. He developed the law of motion. He also developed calculus. If it wasn't for Isaac Newton, all you students would never have had to bother with taking calculus. But he invented it, and that's what you have to use to accurately, mathematically calculate the planetary motions. And they are very accurate, and basically still used to this day in many applications. Now the scientific community felt like they kind of had it down as to what was going on in the universe. But there were some things that needed to be looked at. In the late 1800s, James Clerk Maxwell began to look at some of the things closer to home, you might say. He was into electricity and magnetism and that sort of thing, electromagnetic fields. He was the first to point out that light is a wave-like disturbance, and it is combined with electromagnetic field. He postulated that light travels at a fixed speed, kind of like a ripple in a pond is the way he described it. He also discovered that visible light is only a part of the range of the electromagnetic waves, which range from X-rays to microwaves. And in addition to he did a lot in that area of electromagnetic discoveries. And then about the same time, the late 1800s, along came Darwin with the Origin of the Species. And of course, what Darwin the heart of what Darwin proposed was that natural selection was the way that life, complex life, has arisen. And it's kind of interesting, he's using it as his title, The Origin of the Species, but one thing that was not covered was the origin of life. Everything that Darwin talked about began with there was already life, and this life somehow evolved, as the common term is today. And but it could not, did not address the origin of life. That remained a mystery at that time. And so then we come to the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 20th century, around 1900. And at that particular time, at the beginning of the 20th century, it was basically believed, and pretty strongly believed by scientists, that the universe had always existed in an unchanging state. Now, that was the scientific belief, or that the universe had been created at some finite time in the past, but it was created more or less like we see it today. And there had been no changes, basically. It was just, boom, it was all there. Those were kind of the two beliefs. One was more the scientific approach. One was more held from a religious perspective. And in addition to that, by the early 1900s, Darwin's theory of evolution was being accepted as a reasonable explanation for how complex life forms came about. So that's kind of where we were at the beginning of the 20th century. There was a lot of confidence at that time that scientists had pretty much figured it all out. And they had figured it out in a way that they believed basically that physics and mathematics could account for everything. That there wasn't really a need for God. And so we begin to have this religion versus what's often referred to as scientific materialism. Now, scientific materialism is that, as respect to life, that life and the universe, for that matter, developed through strict mathematical laws of physics or blind chance, that it didn't leave any room for God there. They said, no, it's all materialistic. It can all be explained by natural laws. And then there was, on the other hand, the religious belief that all life had a supernatural origin from God. And so there was this kind of conflict there. So if we look at the state of scientific thinking at the beginning of the 20th century, we can see that there were certain concepts that were just givens. One was that time is an independent dimension that extends to infinity and went back to negative infinity, you might say. In other words, there's always been time. There was no beginning, there's no end of time. It's just minus infinity to infinity. That was one of the basic principles of scientific thinking back in the early 1900s. Another one is that space is three-dimensional. Stretching without limit in every direction. So they thought space was infinite in every direction. And a third one was that energy cannot be created or destroyed, just changed in form, was another strong belief. that the behavior of the universe is well understood and predictable, because they were. But at that time, we were doing a pretty good job of predicting things like the movements in the heavens and things of that nature. And that evolution explains the patterns of life was another belief. And that the basic building block of the universe was the atom. You know, it reached the point where, okay, you got... the basic building block, this atom that has protons, neutrons, and the nucleus, and have electrons orbiting around it like a little miniature universe or a little miniature solar system. And that was it. That's the basic of life. You can't go any further, any smaller than that. So all of these things were beliefs. One more that I should mention here. The universe has always existed. This was the other scientific belief. Now, this last one is kind of important because if scientists can prove that the universe has always existed, then we don't need a creator. That alleviates the need for God, does it not? At least from that perspective, it would alleviate the need for God. And so you can see now some of these things are very accurate. You know, talking about time and space, we'll talk more about that in just a minute when Albert Einstein came along. But we still basically operate under a lot of these things, and they give pretty accurate results. But it basically said, well, there's no need for God in this kind of scenario. And that was kind of the thinking. We're enlightened. We don't need to have these mysterious beliefs of some kind of magic or something happen. You know, that kind of attitude was taking place at that time. And so that's, and so here we're talking about, you know, 2,000 years, basically. And here's where we are. And in that last 300 years or so, a tremendous amount of discoveries were made. And you might say humankind felt like we really got this figured out. And then came Albert Einstein and the discoveries of the last 100 years, basically. Now, Albert Einstein came up with the things he's most well known for, the two basic theories, theory of special relativity, which basically concerns gravity, and then in 1915, the general theory of relativity, which is more all-inclusive in terms of explaining the universe and what's in it. Basically, the general theory of relativity, you might say, replaces Newton's theories. Now, let's look at some of the key points here in Einstein's theories as relates to what I'm going to talk about today. One of the key points is that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. That's the limit for speed in the universe, the speed of light. And I might add, as I'm going through these, everything that Einstein's theories have said, every time you can experimentally check them, and there's been a lot of different ways to experimentally check some of the things in Einstein's theories, they've always turned out to be correct. So the experimental evidence says that, yeah, up to this point, everything we've tested has verified that Einstein's theory is correct. And of course, you know, that's a limited amount of experimentation, you might say, because it's kind of hard to test some of Einstein's principles in his theory. But it's been concluded, for example, that the speed of nothing can travel faster than the speed of light is one of the bedrocks of his theories. And this is a key thing. As part of his theory, time turned out to be a physical property and not constant. Time can vary. Now, this is a kind of a mind-boggling thing to say, well, time is part of the physical universe. Nobody had ever viewed time that way before. Time was just kind of out there by itself. But here it said, no, it's physical, and it has some tremendous implications that we'll talk about as far as God is concerned in a few minutes here. He always also proposed the famous formula as part of his theories that E equals mc squared. Energy is equal to the mass times the speed of light squared. Speed of light is like 180,000 miles per second, I believe, roughly. And you square that, you get a really big number. And you multiply that by a small mass, and you get a lot of energy. That's where atomic and hydrogen bombs came from, is this relationship. A little small amount of mass can release a huge amount of energy because of this relationship. In addition to that, he proposed that space-time, you can't look at just space, and time is two separate things. Space and time are related, and that it's curved. And he also came up with something in his formulations that said, well, the universe must be expanding. But there was no observations at that time that the universe might be expanding. Belief was still that the universe is pretty much the way it's always been, and certainly not expanding. And as I mentioned, you know, how going back to Ptolemy, how he put in his little orbits of the individual planets, small orbits, as opposed to just the big orbits, the fudge factor to make the experimental evidence match the theory. Well, Einstein did not know, neither did anybody else, that the universe indeed was expanding. And so he had to do something and put in a fudge factor. And it's hard to really picture it, because you can't. How do you picture space and time together? But he, one of the things that he did is he showed that gravity influences space-time. It warps it. There's curvature due to the force of gravity. Now, he didn't believe that his theory of the expanding universe. So what he did, he introduced what's been referred to as the cosmological constant. It's like an anti-gravity force that balanced the universe's tendency to expand. So his equation showed the universe expanding. So he added another term that was pushing back the other way. So there was no expansion. So that's what he formulated. He said it was his greatest mistake later on, once it was discovered that the universe does appear to be expanding. And so later on, didn't need that term. But now, just the last few years, you've heard of dark energy, dark matter. Seems to be needing this cosmological constant again. That needs to be in there. You know, so scientists think, well, maybe he was right after all. But he put it in as a fudge factor, basically, just to make his theory fit the experiments, what was observed at that time. You know, so that's what he was doing, was just kind of making it work, just like Ptolemy did almost 2,000 years earlier. Now, this was mind-boggling in itself, what Einstein did, and there was a lot of people didn't believe it at first. They started trying to find the ways we could test it, and they eventually devised ways that they could test this theory. But in the meantime, in the late 20s, Edwin Hubble proposed that the universe was expanding from experimental observations. And what he did he basically wanted to find out how far different stars were, what the distance was. And you can measure the closest stars by geometry. You know, if you take, here's the sun and here's the Earth, and if the Earth is over here, you can aim at a star and measure an angle it makes with the plane of the rotation of the Earth. 6 months later, the Earth gets over here to the other side, you can take another angle, and you know the diameter of the Earth's orbit here, you can measure this distance, and for a triangle, if you have two angles on one side, you know everything about the triangle. You know, from the rest is just geometry. So he would measure stars up to, I think, 30 million light years or something like that by geometry. But once they got too far away, the angles were so small you couldn't measure them. And he went to something else. And he was measuring using redshift. He observed that when you look at the planets, look at the stars, they emit lights that have various components in various amounts. And that's basically how they judge what a star is made of, about how much light of the different colors that are being emitted. And so he was looking at redshift, and what he noticed was that what they call these absorption lines, these dark lines that will show up, and they shifted. They moved it to the red side as he was using some of these techniques to measure the distance of these really deep space stars. And what he concluded was, well, if they're shifting to the red side, the wavelength of the light coming in must be expanding. And the only way that could happen is that the star is moving away. The star is moving away and sending out light, so the wavelength gets longer. If an object is moving towards you, the wavelength will compress. And he looked at lots of stars, and they were all going away. They were all moving away. And so he used this scientific evidence to say the universe must be expanding. Einstein was right after all. It was basically the conclusion there. And he did a lot of things. I guess you can kind of see this here. You know, some of the distance in light years that he came up with and some of these measurements. Virgo, it's not too far away, only 78 million light years, but you go down here to Hydra, and it's over 3 billion light years away. So he was measuring some deep space stuff. But one thing else he discovered in the course of his studies is the further the star was, or in some cases it was galaxies, the further away they were, the faster they were moving. So the conclusion was that not only is the universe expanding, but it's speeding up. It's expanding faster. Now, the most common analogy that's used to represent the universe is expanding, one you can visualize, is like the blowing up of a balloon. You know, here's the balloon, and these are all galaxies, and as this balloon is blown up, the universe is expanding, and so what's happening, this distance, say, between these two galaxies, is pretty small here, but as the balloon blows up, it gets bigger. But the distance between every one of these galaxies gets bigger. So from our perspective, we see everything moving away from us, but the concept is, well, the universe is just blowing up like a balloon, so to speak. But it's like a four-dimensional balloon of both space and time. And so this just kind of revolutionized science back in the first half of the 20th century. And at the same time this was going on, while people like Einstein were looking at the depths, and Hubble were looking at the depths of the universe, there were a bunch of people that were looking the other direction, looking at the atom. And what came out of these studies was what's referred to as quantum theory, quantum mechanics. And this was pretty much just as astounding as Einstein's discoveries were on a universal scale, that quantum theory came about. You know, up until this point, the idea was, yeah, you had electrons orbiting proton and neutron nucleus. Well, they got into studying quantum physics and said, well, wait, these electrons, these protons, these neutrons, they aren't the smallest things. They're composed of other things, like quarks. A proton, for example, is composed of two up quarks and one down quark, whereas a neutron is composed of one up quark and two down quarks. You probably already knew that. I didn't have to tell you that, huh? But then there's all these other, and they keep discovering these new elements that compose, that are parts of things like the neutrons, electrons, and protons. You know, the biggest thing in the last few years been making the news is bosons, particularly the Higgs boson. Now, I would be happy to explain all this to you in a minute or two if I had any idea of what it all meant myself. But needless to say, though, the important thing from our perspective here is that quantum theory, it was basically realized early on that quantum theory is probabilistic in nature. Now, what this means, basically, is that even if you know, and we're talking about, you know, below atom level, atom and smaller, and at that level, given if you knew complete information about the state of a physical system, whether it was an atom, a molecule, whatever, its later behavior cannot, in general, be predicted with certainty. Now, just because you know that the electron is here and the nucleus is here, you know that, doesn't mean you can predict where the electron is going to be with complete certainty a microsecond later. It means you can come up with a pretty good probability of where it's going to be. You know, there's likely a 50% probability to be here, a 30% probability to be over here, 10% probability to be here. But you can't actually predict it. That's the conclusion of the study of quantum mechanics. And so it throws, you might say, another kink in understanding what in the world is going on. This is getting too complicated. Now, in 1970, Stephen Hawking and his colleague, I forget his first name, Penrose, his last name, in looking and studying the most recent discoveries, they said, general relativity has so far been met all the tests of validity, and it still has met all the tests to this very day. So under that assumption, if then the theory of relativity is true, then at some point in the past, the universe had a beginning. And when the universe was concentrated at a single point. So you say, okay, if it's expanding, if it had a beginning, at some point you can backtrack, say, well, it must have all been together at one point in a single point. And, of course, that gave rise to the Big Bang Theory, which was modified several times, the hot Big Bang Theory. The hot inflationary Big Bang Theory is what's currently there. I've shown you this slide before, but it's a nice graphic from NASA that kind of shows, okay, everything was over here at a point. Yeah. How big was that point? The size of a period, the size of an atom. You know, nobody knows exactly. Very, very small is what the theory says. And that all of a sudden there was the Big Bang. And everything started expanding. The original Big Bang theory said, okay, it was the bang, and this from this point, everything started expanding. But it didn't match the data. It didn't match the data. And so they said, well, how can we make it match the data? And so they said, well, Copernicus did it by putting in a fudge factor. Einstein did it by putting in a fudge factor. Maybe we can come up with a fudge factor that makes it fit the data. And what they came up with was inflation. And they've concluded that if at the bang, when this universe started expanding, instead of just expanding physically, according to the laws of nature, it suddenly inflated to like half the size it is today in a microsecond or less. Instantaneously, the universe went from a point to half the size or so of what we see today in the visible universe. And when they made that assumption, they put that factor in, it worked to help match the data they were observing. And without getting into all the detail of that, it helped. So what we have then is two things. One, all matter was compressed into a single point, and there was a bang. And two, at the bang, there was this sudden expansion of the universe from a point to somewhere around the half the size it is today. And since that time, it's been gradually expanding. Okay, so that's where we are here, you might say. And but when the Big Bang Theory came out, scientists didn't like it much. Now, here were some of the comments. Albert Einstein said, one cannot take such possibilities seriously. British physicist Arthur Eddington said, the notion of a beginning is repugnant to me. I simply do not believe that the present order of things started off with a bang. The expanding universe is preposterous, incredible, it leaves me cold. And so it gives you a little bit of an idea of how hard it was to accept. This is a German physicist, Walter Nernst. To deny the infinite duration of time would be to betray the very foundation of science. That's a pretty strong statement. Our cosmetologist, Andre Lind, the non-stationary character of the Big Bang Theory, based on the Friedman cosmological model, seems very unpleasant to many scientists in the 50s. Anyway, so it wasn't accepted very well, but gradually it was. Arno Penzias wrote later on, the easiest way to fit the observations with the least number of parameters is one in which the universe was created out of nothing in an instant and continues to expand. So he said, okay, it fits. It fits what we're seeing out there. So, it must have happened. Now, so we're at the point where science pretty much says the universe had a beginning. And that is major in terms of God. And so, and you might say, here's my point, basically, of this sermon, and that is, have 20th century discoveries undercut the Bible or not? Have they undercut the Bible or not? And I want to look at this a little bit because, you know, if the universe had an origin, then you have to ask and answer the question of who or what created it. You know, you have to do that. And I'm going to take you through some logic related to this in a minute. And you could do the same thing for life. If the universe had an origin, obviously life had an origin. And so if life had an origin, who or what created the first living thing? That's something else that has to be answered. Now, the interesting thing is that there's no scientific explanation for how either one of these things could have happened. How life could have started, or how the universe could have suddenly started from natural laws. Zero. Nana. Nothing in science can explain that. Now, let's look at it from a logical viewpoint. Scientists sometimes don't like to use logic because, you know, basically scientists are kind of in this thing of materialism. Everything is natural laws. Now, logic's not natural law, so forget about logic. Everything's natural laws. But if the universe had a beginning, what caused it? And so we have to ask, well, is God the first cause? You know, can we look at that logically and say, is God the first cause? Now, there are two types of causes. One you might refer to as simultaneous causes. Now, a good example of simultaneous cause would be the Earth's mass causes gravity. Now, those two things occur simultaneously. It's the Earth's mass that creates gravitation. You know, so you can say it caused it, but they happen simultaneously. It's not like, well, there was an Earth, and then somewhere along the way, here came gravity. They exist simultaneously. But it's the result of the mass of the Earth that there is gravity, or the mass of any object that creates gravity. So that's a simultaneous cause. Now, prior to the 20th century, the universe and all its interactions were considered to be simultaneously caused. Whereas it had been there forever, from a scientific viewpoint. It had been there forever. If it was caused, it must have all happened, together. Kind of thing. So that was the thinking. But if for simultaneous cause, you know, is there a need for a first cause if the universe has always existed? And that's why so many scientists were so uncomfortable with the idea that the universe had a beginning. Because it said we've got to then determine a cause, a first cause. Now, another type of cause are non-simultaneous causes. And here we're talking about where we got a line, you might say, a path, because the causes did not occur at the same time, they're sequential. You know, like you're a person, and you were caused by your parents, right? You were a product of your parents. So you could say you were caused by your parents were caused by your grandparents were caused by your great-grandparents. There's a progression there. But if you go back to the universe had a beginning, there had to be a first cause of you. Right? You know, so that's non-simultaneous causes that we're talking about. You know, we could look at it in all kinds of levels. A Broadway play. What's the cause of a Broadway play? I said, well, the actors are the cause. They perform, so they cause the play. But there needed to be a director to direct the actors, train them, get the things organized the right way, recruit the actors. So you could say, well, no, the director calls the actors and the actors calls the play. But then there had to be a producer, which lines up the financing and organizes things. So the producer calls the director, calls the actors, who calls the play. And you could take it back further and say, well, at some point it must have been a writer that had this idea. So somewhere back there, there's a first cause. Typically it might be a writer who has this idea, and he puts it together, and from that originates the play. So, you know, but it's the first cause. Anytime there's non-simultaneous causes, there has to be a first cause if the universe had a beginning. So, if the Big Bang Theory, with modifications, ultimately becomes the complete explanation, would that explain the first cause? And the answer to that is no. It wouldn't explain it. It would simply say that it necessitates a first cause. There has to be a first cause. So what is that first cause? Science says, I don't know. They have no clue. They don't know where to begin. But the first cause is called God in the Bible. Now we know the scriptures, Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. God says he did it. God says he is the first cause. In Psalm 33, verses 6 through 9, by the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and the host of them by the breadth of his mouth. He gathered up the waters of the sea together as a heap. He lay up the deep and the storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke and it was done. He commanded and it stood fast. Psalm 33, verses 6 through 9. So, God and the Bible is consistent with science, is that there has to be a first cause, and it has to be outside of the universe. God. Now, we could ask another question. And that is God the necessary cause? Does it have to be God, in other words? Is God the necessary cause? Now, there are two types of beings or facts. One type is we refer to as contingent truths. They don't have to be true, but they are. In other words, there are truths that are contingent on something else. Contingent truths. So stick with me a minute here on this. For example, there is a rose bush in my yard. That's a truth. But it's a contingent truth. It doesn't have to be true, but it simply is. Why? Well, because at some point, somebody had it planted. Me. Somebody had it planted. But you can go back further and say, well, it had to come from somewhere. Some nursery had to have this thing, and I had to get it and have it planted. But you go further back, somebody had to grow the seeds or whatever. The rose bushes have seeds, I don't know. But anyway, yeah, you could go back. But again, if the universe had a beginning, you know, that takes you back to a first cause. But there are, but so. So there's these contingent truths, but then there's something else. You know, like I was saying, you could ask the question, who planned it, where did it come from, all that kind of thing. But then there are necessary truths. Now, necessary truth is something different. It's a truth that just is. It's not contingent on anything else. It simply is true. Now, what's an example of a contingent truth? Well, one example is that the number 5 is a prime number. So, we get into a little math here. We'll make you engineers out of you before the sermon's over. Remember what a prime number is? A prime number is any number that, when divided by either 1 or itself, it produces, that's the only way you can produce a whole number, is dividing by 1 or itself. If you divide by any other number, you will get some fraction. That's a prime number. Now, so 1's a prime number, 2's a prime number, 3's a prime number, 4's not a prime number because you can divide 4 by 2 and get 2. 5's a prime number, 6 is not a prime number because you can divide by 2 and get 3. 7's a prime number, 8's not a prime number, you can divide by 4, divide by 2 and get a whole number. 9 is not a prime number, you can divide by 3 and get a whole number 3. 10's not a prime number, 11's a prime number. How about 317? Is that a prime number? Get a little harder as you get higher up. I believe that one is a prime number, if I remember correctly. But the point is, it's not contingent on anything. It simply is. You know, 5 is a prime number. You don't say, well, it didn't used to be a prime number, but it was made a prime number. It simply is. You know, that's a necessary truth. It simply is. Let me give you another example here. 2 plus 2 equals 4. I'm using some complicated math here, so stick with me. But, you know, that's another example of a truth. Now, would you say, for example, that 2 plus 2 was 4? You don't say 2 plus 2 will be 4. You simply say 2 plus 2 is 4. It's simply a necessary truth. It's not caused by anything else. It just is. Okay, so let's take this logic a little bit further. You know, what the question here is God the necessary cause? You know, every contingent being or fact must have a cause or explanation. It's contingent on something else, so it must have some kind of cause or explanation. All right, let's take the logic a little bit further. Such cases cannot be circular. Now, sometimes scientists like circular reasoning. You have to be careful about that. For example, scientists might say that the physical universe can be sufficiently explained by the laws and equations of physics. And then they'll say, what is true for physics must be true for all reality. Therefore, to rationally understand reality is the same as to understand it through all laws, equations of physics. And that's kind of circular reasoning. Now, circular reasoning always has a flaw, and the flaw is that second thing there. What is true for physics must be true for all reality. That's an assumption that cannot be proven by science. But it's just assumed. It's just thrown in there. So you can't use circular reason and get anywhere. But therefore, contingent beings or facts must have a first cause. But this first cause must be uncaused. It's not the first cause, it's something else caused it. So the first cause must be uncaused. You know, like we're talking about a necessary truth, a necessary being. It can't have a cause if it's the first cause. And therefore, it must be a necessary being or a fact or a truth rather than a contingent being or fact or truth because of our first statement here. Every contingent fact must have a cause. So, the bottom line is that God is a necessary cause, not just a first cause, but a necessary cause. In other words, since the universe had a beginning, it can be traced back to a first cause, a necessary being, a being that just is. A being that just is. Now, when you look at this logic, it gives you, or at least it did for me, it gives me a new perspective on something in the Bible that you know, you read it and you say, yeah, I kind of get it, but I don't get it. You know, it's the Bible speaks to the necessity of God as a first cause. God is a necessary cause as well as a first cause. It goes to Exodus 3 and verse 13 and 14. Then Moses said to God, indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. Okay, well, yeah, that's kind of a good answer. But then he said, thus you will say to the children of Israel, I am has sent you. Yeah, now, you see what, it kind of sounds like what God was saying to Moses is that it just is. I am just God. I'm not, and that's, you know, there's no beginning, no end, anything. I am. Period. Now, carry this a little bit further. In the New Testament, in John 8:57-58, when he was having this discussion with the scribes and Pharisees, then the Jews said to him, you are yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham? And Jesus said to them, most assuredly I say to you that before Abraham was, I am. Now, was Jesus Christ some kind of illiterate that didn't know the tenses? Now, shouldn't he have said, before Abraham was, I was? But he didn't say that. And he knew the tenses. So what he said was, before Abraham was, I am. See, it's a necessary first cause that God, it just is. Now, there's a lot of implications here when you look at this. You know, he didn't say, I was. Yeah, I was there before. You know, he didn't say that. He just said simply, I am. Of course, those Jews know exactly what he's talking about. He was calling himself God. The first cause, the necessary cause. Now, this brings up a related thing that is implied by this, and that is God outside of time? Now, general relativity theory postulates that time is a physical quantity. If time is a physical quantity, if that's true, and the evidence to stage points to it being true, then God, the cause of all this, is outside of that. Which makes sense for God to say, I simply am. It's not that I was, it's not that I will be, I just am. I just exist. And so, and this relates then to one of the, what I'd call one of the strangest quirks in all of physics, that the speed of light is a constant. Speed of light is a constant. As I mentioned, speed of light is around 186,000 miles per second. Everything else that moves obeys a simple law of physics, and that's the addition of velocities. It doesn't work with light. Yeah, if you're driving along in a car at 30 miles an hour, you stick your arm out the window and throw a baseball forward at 30 miles an hour. How fast is that baseball traveling with respect to the ground? You add the two velocities. The velocity of the car, the velocity of the baseball, is traveling 60 miles an hour. That's the addition of velocities. What they have found out is when a body is emitting light and is moving towards you, you think, okay, the speed of the light coming towards you should be the speed of the thing emitting the light plus the not normal speed of light. So they should add. They don't. Speed of light is constant. You measure something going away from you. Well, the speed of light that we're seeing should slow down because it's moving away, not coming as fast. So, but same. Always the same. Now, how do they know that? There are a lot of stars that occur in pairs that are rotating around each other. So you can measure the speed of light on one of these stars when it's moving towards you, but later on it rotates and starts moving away from you. But the speed of light never changes. Whether it's moving towards you, whether it's moving away from you, it never changes. It's a constant. Now, if the speed of light doesn't change, then time must change. because speed is given in distance per second, you know, miles per hour, something like that sort of thing. If something's got to change, so it's time that's changing. And Stephen Hawking likes to talk about this, and you can go into the future theoretically. If you could build a spaceship, go find a black hole and orbit that black hole. And if you get right in the right orbit around the black hole, you can get your speed up to near the speed of light. And you spend, in your own spaceship, you spend a day or so orbiting the black hole near the speed of light. Well, time has slowed down for you. Whereas on Earth, time is moving ahead. And if you then leave that orbit, go back to Earth, it may be hundreds of years later. So it's like you've gone to the future. But it's kind of mind-boggling when you think about it. But it's one of the things that shows that time is something very different, but it is part of the physical universe. It's not outside the universe. You know, time can slow down or speed up depending on how fast you're traveling with respect to somebody else. Now, so like I said, like everything else, time, if this is part of the universe, had a beginning. The Big Bang is true. Time began at the bang. Okay, so it had a beginning. But God was there before time began, if He created it. You know, so that places God outside of time. And so it makes a little more sense why God in Christ would simply say, I am. Not I was or will be or anything. I simply am. I just am. Now, it's interesting. This idea is not really new. You can go back to writers like Thomas Aquinas and go way back, and they puzzle over this kind of thing, and they didn't know what we know, you might say, about physics and everything. But the idea was not new to them, and they kind of looked at it by using an analogy of a book and an author. You know, so a book has a timeline. You know, the book begins at a certain date, things happen, it finally ends, and it's a later time. It may be flashbacks and some stuff, but basically books follow a timeline. Now, if the characters in the book could reason and say, who created us? And when were we created? You know, if the book starts in 1970, and I said, well, we must have been created in 1970. That's what the characters would think if they could reason, right? But the author may not have written the book till 2013 and was writing kind of a historical novel. So the author is completely outside the time in the book. You know, so you can kind of look at it that way and understand what it means to be not just a first cause, but a necessary first cause. You know, God is timeless. And the Bible confirms this. Paul, a bondservant of God, this is Titus 1, verses 1 and 2. Paul, a bondservant of God and an apostle of Jesus Christ, according to the faith of God's elect and the acknowledgement of the truth which accords with godliness, in hope of eternal life, which God, who cannot lie, promised before time began. So here Paul is saying that before time began, there was God. Now, how can the universe originate from nothing? How can it come from nothing? You never hear that question asked much, because nobody has an answer. Scientific materialists rely on one of three possible concepts to explain it, and as a natural phenomenon, at least. One is natural selection. can't explain it with natural selection. Natural selection can only begin after there is already something happened. After there's already life, for example, for natural selection to begin, because that doesn't make any sense. They say, well, the laws of nature. Well, what law? What law caused something to come from nothing? What law caused that initial inflation that they believe happened? There are no laws in physics like that. And then the last one is the catch-all chance. Well, it was just the luck of the draw. It just kind of happened. These are the kind of answers that you get from scientists. Yeah. None of these alternatives really have any make any sense in terms of the origin of the universe. So how do scientists try to explain creation? They love to speculate that it didn't really happen. It didn't really happen. You know, one of the things they like to speculate about is the Big Crunch. They say, okay, the Big Bang happened. Here's their argument. The Big Bang happened. Boom, the universe expands. But at some point, it's going to stop expanding and fall back on itself and crunch. And then, boom, it'll expand again and crunch. And boom, it expands again. And so they say, oh, obviously the universe is infinite. You don't need a God. That doesn't fit things very well. Yeah. The laws of physics don't indicate that the universe is just kind of bounce back and forth. Expand, contract. It doesn't, you know, what happens when you drop a ball on the floor? Bounces pretty high the first time, bounces less second time, bounces, and finally it stops bouncing altogether. Yeah. That's the second law of thermodynamics, entropy. And that's what would happen if this thing was going back and forth. Eventually, it would stop. Okay? Because of entropy. The universe runs down. You know, that sort of thing. So, if it's not infinite, then how can you argue it didn't have a beginning? You know, and then, of course, in addition to that, the present data indicates the expansion is getting faster, not slowing down. And the first thing, it's going to slow down, we're going to have a big crunch, and that'll explain everything. Now it's getting faster. Expansion is speeding up. And so, it doesn't make any sense. Now, the second is baby universes. Remember, I'm going to use the balloon analogy here to try to explain this briefly. Baby universes, you have this expanding balloon of universes. You know, the universe is expanding. But what happens if you could kind of pinch off a piece of the balloon, catch a little bit of a bubble of the balloon, and then it starts expanding? A baby universe is born. And when that baby universe gets to full maturity, a little bubble is pinched off. So that's the baby universe theory. Doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? Who does the pinching off, for example? But yeah, but that's one idea to try to get around this. And then there's the eternal inflation, which is kind of like the baby universe, is that the universe expands, and using the balloon analogy again, well, like a little blister forms on the universe, and a bubble pops out. And it expands, that sort of thing, eternal inflation. And then one of the ones that is becoming more popular recently is multi-universes. And the multi-universe idea, I'll use the analogy of a carbonated drink. You know, you pour a bottle of Coke into a glass and all these bubbles start rising up. Well, the analogy is each of these bubbles, consider it like a universe. And so there's the multiple universes. And our universe just happened to have all the right things for life and so forth. But there's all these millions of universes around, infinite number of universes. So that's another theory. None of these things have the remotest bit of evidence. Pure speculation. But if you read things, scientists are really taking it serious. Psalm 102:25-26. Of old you laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you will endure. Yes, they will grow old like a garment, like a cloak. You will change them, and they will be changed. So, yeah, it's a creation. It's the work of the Creator's hands. And scientists say, yeah, eventually this universe is going to die out. Don't worry, it won't be in our lifetime. But, you know, that's what they're saying. It's going to eventually die out. Proverbs 8:22-31. This is an interesting way this is phrased in Proverbs. The subject is wisdom, and it's speaking like wisdom is something that just is. And that's the context of this, and we're jumping into the middle of it here. But the Lord possessed me at the beginning of His way, before His works of old. You know, so when God was getting ready to do the works of old, wisdom was already there. Is what this is saying? I have been established from everlasting, always been there. It just is, and has always been. From the beginning, before there was ever an earth, when there was no depths, I was brought forth, when there was no fountains abounding with water. Then going down to verse 27, when He prepared the heavens, I was there. When He drew a circle on the face of the deep, when He established the clouds above, when He strengthened the fountains of the deep, when He assigned to the sea its limit, so that the waters would not transgress His command. When He marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside Him as a master craftsman. I was daily His delight, rejoicing always before Him, rejoicing in His inhabited world, and my delight was with the sons of men. Now this is wisdom speaking. You know, eternal wisdom, you might say. So what's the conclusion here? First of all, scientific evidence points to the creation of the universe. The Bible says the universe was created. Science now says the universe was created. No conflict there. In addition to that, scientific evidence indicates that something cannot be created without causation. You know, science basically says that. That's the whole idea of science, that things are caused other things, and you can predict them. Therefore, since the universe had a beginning, there must have been a first cause. The unlimited power and wisdom of such a first cause would, by any definition, anything that could create a whole universe, by any definition, would be called God. And this God is also a necessary cause. Not just the first cause, but necessary. And this God is outside the realm of time. Time's physical. God is spiritual. And there is no physical evidence that the universe did not have a beginning. Only speculation. Now, so this, you know, this kind of logic and science points to the origin of the universe having a beginning. Points to God. It's a proof of God. It's one of the strongest proofs of God, but not the only one. So next time, 2 weeks from now, we're going to talk about the origin of life and how that is also a proof of God, and go into a lot of details about that.